Okay, got it. Before we launch, can I make a couple of announcements?
Wait, just to me or on the recording?
No, to the world.
Okay.
Like right now. Okay, so
Okay.
this is actually very exciting, and you probably would want to hear about this, and so would your audience. The first ever ROGD conference is taking place in November. So Jen Specht is putting it on. It's called What We Know and What We're Learning. And this is really exciting because Stella is going to be giving a talk, as well as a parent who's part of the Jen Specht organization, Stella O'Malley. And then also Dr. David Bell, former UK Tavistock clinician. And Dr. Lisa Littman is giving a talk. And there's going to be a Q&A section where the audience can ask questions. And this is the first ever conference of its kind. It's a web conference. So if anyone is interested, they should definitely check it out. It's going to be great.
And what day is that?
November 20th.
Okay.
The festivities start around 3:30 Eastern time.
Okay.
So according to time change conundrums, I have no idea what time that will be for me. I'm really
But
going nuts with the time conversion stuff.
is that a Saturday? A weekend? I'm just
I
going to look it up.
believe it is.
And it is. It's a Saturday. So Saturday
Yeah.
at noon Pacific, which would be different time in Arizona.
Yeah, I don't want to know. I'm
Far
really
back.
dreading this. Well,
So you
because
think it would be
Stella
one?
changed time already. All my UK people already changed time. And then my US people are going to change time in a couple of days, but we don't change time.
No, you don't.
So I think for me, in order to match my clients' schedules, I'm going to have to work an hour later every day going forward. Everything will be later.
Yeah.
It's going to be really weird.
Okay. You'll get through it. Your phone will tell you what to
I'm scared of that. My phone is taking over my life. Trying to really,
do.
me and Stella are talking about this. We'll probably do an episode on it. Technology, just like merging with our biological hardware, like where you end, where the technology begins, is really blurry and it's messing with my brain and all of these things.
Elon Musk, who's the founder of PayPal and Tesla and SpaceX, which is like Latinx but with rockets.
SpaceX.
He said on Joe Rogan, he was talking about we're all androids now, and Rogan's like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "No, look, how do you treat your phone? How far away is that from you at any given time?"
Yeah, it's really true. It's really true. Well, here we are chatting on the interwebs.
Yeah, we're
So it's
merged.
got good things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was there a second announcement?
Yeah, there is. It's not as concrete as the conference that I just mentioned, but some colleagues and I have put together something called the Gender Exploratory Therapy Association. And we're very excited about it. It's really the first organization of its kind. It is both a directory of clinicians and also a networking platform for therapists who believe that gender dysphoric clients deserve proper exploration of all of their issues as a whole person. And so we're really thrilled about some of the kind of membership features that will be available. We're going to have a lot of resources for therapists, parents, gender dysphoric individuals listed on the website. And we're hoping to also put out things like trainings and workshops. And we really are, this is, for all the work that so many people are doing around this issue. There was not like a central hub for therapists. So we're very excited to kind of launch this project and get, feedback from clinicians who want to join and want to be part of it. So we're very excited and we hope people will take a look. The website is up and ready to go. We have articles, resources up. You can look for local therapists, though our directory is very small right now, but it will be growing. So yes, I encourage everyone to take a look and I'll give you the website for our show notes.
I got it.
Thank you. Okay, bye. See you later.
Wait, hold
Just
on.
kidding. I'm just kidding.
I think I have your
That was the whole conversation.
well, hold on. I think I have your jingle.
Oh.
Set aside your tender worry. Sink your stride to our gender journey. Your body's not just an appliance. Come join the Gender Exploratory Therapy Alliance.
Now we have to change the name of the organization because it's not alliance, it's association.
Oh, so can you re-jingle? Association, appropriation. Yeah. Your gender and sex aren't an appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
At the Gender Exploratory Therapy Association. There's a lot of gender.
I really like it. It's very like 70s. I really like it. It's like Sesame Street.
I was thinking more Three's Company, but whatever.
Oh yeah, that too. Okay, great.
You know what?
Yeah.
I was asked in this interview today with this really cool guy. I don't have his name up, so I'll post it on my channel. It was a good conversation. I don't like being interviewed because who wants to listen to me babble unless you show up to my...
Oh, people love to listen to you. But anyway, go on.
I can't conceive of wanting to do that because I do it so much to myself. Anyways, and he asked me, are you ever nervous about dealing with these issues of, you know, race and gender? I'm like, well, not really. But I do get really, really nervous when I sing. Like my whole
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I don't sing in public, so
you don't?
I can't even imagine. No.
It
makes me nervous.
Do you have any performative?
I do. I have a dance background. So dancing in public doesn't make me nervous when I'm performing. But if people are like, you're a dancer, dance. I'm like, I can't do it. But if it's like my performance, it's a piece of cake.
What do people
I don't know
do
if that happens to you. Like, if people find out that you're a musician, do they say, oh, yeah, sing something? Like, just like,
you're paint my house, dude.
You're a painter, paint my house. Yeah.
Yeah, no. But they do hear that I'm a podcaster, so they just start talking to me. And
oh, yeah, start podding. Show us your pod.
Oh, you're on it. I just listen. So speaking of exploratory things, what have you been engaged with intellectually lately?
Well, in terms of consumption, I could talk about consumption and then I could talk about production. I am currently reading Heather Hyings and Brett Weinstein's book, 21st Century Guide to the Century.
Hunter-gatherers.
Yes. It is so great. I mean, it is completely annotated, underlined, dog-eared. I'd love to speak with her one day. There's so many things in there that remind me of the trans kids situation. Lots of parallels. So I'm really enjoying that. I'm reading a book about sleep right now. I was really enjoying it, but it felt like propaganda. Yeah, he says in the book something like, unlike most authors, I completely encourage you, if you start getting sleepy, to just close my book and sleep. Like, it's very... But you know what's funny? I've become so sensitive to ideological material that if I feel like an argument is being presented in kind of a one-sided way, I'm really conscious of it. And this sleep book, while I think he's probably, I mean, he cites a lot of studies and research, which we know has complications with it in and of itself, but I believe he's telling the truth, but it almost feels a bit like propaganda that sleep is this like utopian thing that if everyone slept, all these world problems would disappear. And that if you haven't slept, that is definitely the reason for all your problems. Like, it kind of has that angle. So it's been interesting. So I don't know. I'm kind of a crappy consumer of content now.
Because are you producing so much?
Skeptical.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because you're skeptical. So on that note, I had James Lindsay on, as I do frequently, once a month, hopefully,
yeah.
If times are good. And I was exploring his brain because he has a very active brain. He's, the first time we talked, my intro was like, this guy's brain is like a John Deere, lawnmower. It just goes and you just kind of ride along. And that's just mm-hmm. how he operates. He operates on a very high functioning level. And we were talking about the pitfalls of that. So I was just kind of exploring his mentation style and how he ingests content and makes an argument. And he kind of laid out some kind of interesting things. But one thing that he was kind enough to specify was he riffed a little bit on cognitive bias and how he's really sensitive to that, how it's almost like a physical sensation for him when things don't add up. It's like a puzzle piece that you can't really get in, and it just really bugs him. So physiologically speaking, or even up into the higher ranges of physiognomy and anxiety level, or just like a subtle feeling, how do you know, or how do you begin to tell that something's biased or ideologically motivated? What's the sense? How do you?
That's a really, that's a good question. I would assume that we have to develop that skill. I think part of it has to do with kind of having a radical willingness to be wrong. And I think when, at least for me, when something is presented as a panacea, that automatically sends off some kind of alarm bells for me.
Okay.
Just based on where I'm at in my work, my life as a person.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you're asking. Are you talking about confirmation bias or general cognitive biases?
I'm talking about cognitive dissonance is what James called it.
Oh,
just
okay.
This subtle feeling that something doesn't add up, which mm-hmm. I think cognitive dissonance probably means a little bit more than that, a little stronger than that. But he explained it as that with regards to ideological material, which is what he covers in depth.
Hmm. So you're talking about, like, if James is reviewing a piece of literature or an essay, how does he tell if it's ideologically captured or something? And he saying he has a physical sensation that goes along with that.
Yeah. Well, specifically, I think we were talking in the context of critical theory and its various offshoots, of which you are mopping up one sector of.
Yeah, I think when you kind of are knee deep in these things, you probably develop a kind of sensitivity, and it's almost like certain things become a warning for you. And interestingly, I wonder if, I mean, I know that there's a parallel version of that also going on with people who are indoctrinated in some kind of a belief system. Like certain words are considered dog whistles for some other thing. And then your brain just kind of shuts off the ability to process that information. But, you know, I think we all exist down some kind of rabbit hole. And so I'm sure we all are doing that on and off with various things. I think I'm so familiar with the arguments in gender ideology at this point that it's pretty easy for me to spot them. But when I was first kind of learning about all this and going down this road, I probably didn't have the same level of sensitivity or recognition. I don't know if that makes sense.
And one of the things that you pointed out specifically was a panacea, something that's snake oil of some type or something that has a supreme power to fix many different converging issues, like this univariate solution to a multivariate world.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's a big one. And I think that probably exists in a lot of utopian philosophies of all kinds, just like these solutions. If we just do this, we will reach some kind of resolution and all these other problems will go away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if everybody slept 23 hours a day, a lot of problems would be non-existent.
It's a great idea. 23 hours a day. Wow. What would you do if you only had an hour awake every day? What would you do with that time?
Well, you'd spend the first 45 minutes making coffee. And then the next 3 hours trying to get back to sleep.
Oh my God, that's exactly what would happen. You're totally right. What if we had to like microdose coffee, like in a little thimble? Like that's all you could have? I would not want to wake up. I would just be like, F it, I'm sleeping all the way through.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
that would be forever if I slept through the 1 hour anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So solutions, problems, ingesting. Okay. So with regards to the Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century, what's something that was popping out at you? You said something about the trans stuff, but on what level did that?
Oh my God, so many. I wish I had the book in front of me. Well, one thing that popped to mind immediately was somewhere at the beginning of the book, they say something like, just because we can do it, it doesn't mean we should. And they were talking about kind of medical technology and intervention. And it really struck me, because obviously that's one of the problems. Like, we all want to live in a developed nation where we have the most advanced medical technology. But is anybody slowing down to ask, like, okay, just because we know how to do these things in the lab, just because we can develop these things, do we need to? And are there downsides? Like, what are the risks? And not just risks that you throw other medications at to resolve, but like big picture risks, you know? And they were talking, of course, about the appendix. And if anyone's reading the book, I won't like spoil it for you, but
it's not a thriller, but I think this is just a medical fact.
Oh, I think it's pretty thrilling. I'm every five pages, I'm like, oh my God. but you know, that if something has developed through, and the Omega principle is really interesting too. So they say that we tend to think about things that are evolved as like, and I'm going to botch this, but like physical things in our genetics, our DNA, and our like biological traits. But culture also has evolved, which means it is also evolutionary in that it has served us in some way. And so basically they're saying, you know, if something has evolved over like thousands of generations, we should be very cautious before we throw it away and replace it with something else. We really need to understand it and understand its function before we decide it's unnecessary. And obviously, puberty sounds like one of those things to me. Like, maybe there's a function for puberty that goes beyond just the, like, playing Mr. Potato Head with children. Like, that's what it feels like a lot of the doctors think, is like, well, this is this inconvenient physical trait that will emerge around the time of puberty. So if we can block it, let's. And of course, the principles in the book would caution us that like, this is an adaptive, necessary developmental phase that is important for people to go through.
Mm-hmm. You bring up puberty, which is mostly biological. There's also
and
things
social.
That- it's a social process. You're true. Yeah, you're right. The process of transformation and puberty affects not just the body, but as well the mind and the social beingness of man. But also, on the flip side of that, purely cultural, or almost purely cultural, but you could argue, if you take out the fine tooth comb, that rites of passage are the cultural pubescence that is ratified or institutionalized and codified. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a line in the sand. And you can see this, I pointed this out before, that you see specifically there are parents who get on board with their child's gender journey. And the language that they start using when they're writing about this is one that mimics or mirrors this mm-hmm. rite of passage. That this, mm-hmm. I think it was this Australian woman that was talking about her daughter going through menopause. And she was celebrating her teenage daughter undergoing menopause because it was this transformational experience. So what you might see, or you could read, is that our culture strayed so far from a rite of passage that now we're reinventing it through technology.
Your video on this was one of the most brilliant things I've seen about childhood transition. It was a while ago. It was years ago. I know because I lived in Houston at the time. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. I was raking leaves. Yeah, I remember that.
You were raking leaves? What do you mean?
When
by
you
that?
Texted me and say that that was awesome.
Oh, okay.
I remember I was really toiling good. in the humid grass.
Okay. Raking leaves. Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Hmm. And of course we're gonna see the fallout of that. We're seeing the fallout of that.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. Every few months, both of us, either I will text you or you text me, like, oh, it's going to fall. The house of cards that has been built out of the bodies of ruined children is going to fall. And, you know, Abigail Schreier comes out with a book or an essay, or Barry Weiss publishes something by Abigail Schreier. Bill Maher gets his snooty nose all up in the gender crevasse. But when you mention fallout, it seems like it's going to be one of those things where it's a slow collapse. You know, if you speed it up, it'll be boom. But
I mean, when I say that, I'm talking about the individual lives of young people who are having kind of like slow wake up moments of like, oh my God, what has been done to me? You know, that is a fallout. Mm. I don't necessarily mean that the entire industry of childhood transition is going to collapse in one second. What I mean is all of the lives that were negatively impacted by this very narrow view of the child are going to have moment after moment of like waking up to what has happened to them. Hmm. Do you not see that, or do you disagree?
You said this very narrow view of the child, and I've been kind of exploring here and there when I do interviews, what does trans kid mean? So mm-hmm. I understand what a trans kid mm-hmm. does or doesn't mean, or the problem with that idea, or what that idea creates in its wake. But could you speak to what the narrow view of just the child, what you see people theorizing about what the child is?
I mean, on one hand, there's a tendency to view the child as just like a, especially a teenager, as like a little adult. And I have to credit Dr. Laura Edwards Leeper for talking about this on Megan Dom's podcast. She's a gender clinician. She's a chair of the adolescent division, I think, of WPATH. She's a pretty important person within the affirmative care model, but she has been interviewed for many years now. Like, I think Jesse Single was the first person to put her on people's radar in his Atlantic piece. But anyway, she was talking recently in an interview how a lot of trans therapists, like gender therapists and clinicians, because they are working with adolescents who can talk and articulate things and discuss back and forth, unlike with a small child, you know, they can misunderstand that the adolescent isn't just a little adult who's fully fleshed out. Adolescents are in the most, you know, turbulent and fluctuating, difficult period of time in their growth and development. And they're in a place of seeking, and they're in a place of identity formation, and they're in a mm-hmm. place of impulsiveness, and they're incredibly vulnerable to peer influence. And we don't even have a lot of data on what does it mean to be a young person growing up on social media. Like, that's still coming, because this is all relatively new. So on one level, like one factor here is that the gender affirmative model forgets that young people are in flux, treats them like little adults. And even adults are in flux. I mean, We are all developing throughout our lifetime. So even to think of an adult as some kind of a static being is incorrect, right? But especially not for a teenager. There's also a misunderstanding of the child in relation to the family dynamics, and what person or what group of people or what entities should we look to have the best interest of the child? And somehow this has gotten completely inverted, and the parents are often treated like some kind of enemy or a person who doesn't have the child in mind. So the affirmative model tends to also forget the child is the responsibility of the parents, and that more often than not, you know, absent serious abuse and severe dysfunction, most parents know their kids best and have very important input about what a young person might be going through if they're struggling with something like their identity. So that's a second thing.
A child is a little adult, and a parent is an overprivileged tyrant who doesn't know anything. So the child knows everything. Yeah. The parent doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
That could be a consequence of, well, it sounds classist or elitist in a way, and I'm an elitist in certain respects. I don't think elitism in and of itself is wrong, but I can see how a culture of learning will overprize expertise. And then that notion of expertise, especially in the human sciences, becomes a black box. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, we have this entire infrastructure of idea laundering within the academy, but let's just accept that. So the expert knows, who knows how they know, because it's knowledge that's off limits to these peons, these peasants out there who are acting basically on instinct and self-preservation, right? The relationship of the adult to the child or the parent to the child is one of biological intuition, which, you know, who knows what they don't know? Nobody knows what these parents don't know. So I can see how these expert or the culture of expertise or even expertiseism is partly to blame for this casting out of the parent. So at the same time, a parent, what do they know about what they're doing? What do they know? How do they know what's best for the child? And to what extent does any parent No.
Yeah, it's making me also think about the fact that there can be this illusion that because the therapist or the professional or the expert that you referred to is a neutral third party, they have no skin in the game. They don't have any particular desires for the outcome for that child. You know, so it might make them sound like a neutral party that's really going to be objective. Hmm. And parents might be seen as someone who, you know, they have their own personal fantasies about who their child would become and all this kind of stuff wrapped up, you know? So it's like, I feel like there's always a little grain of truth in these perspectives. Like, of course, people should be mindful that sometimes parents do project their own fantasies of like the life they could have lived onto their child. Like, this is kind of classic, like football dad, you know, making his son do sports when his son doesn't care. Like, so it's not that these things are completely off base, but the kind of degree to which we are framing that as the predominant problem, like every single time a parent has any kind of skepticism about their child's gender identity, the assumption is that they just, they're just transphobic and they don't want to have a transgender child. That's so far off base. So I think it's just an exaggeration of small little things that a professional should have on the back of their mind if they're evaluating like a family dynamic, for example. You know, you should be mindful of those things. But the broad brushstroke should be, hey, parents love their kids. They're doing their best for their kids. They know their kids well, and they have been there observing every step of the way who this child is, what problems that child has, their strengths. Or I mean, that should be the default assumption, unless there are some serious red flags of like something else is going on in this family. The default assumption should be that this is a unit of people who love each other and want the best for this child.
There's a tendency within the contrarian community, the critical community, the cultural critical community, to see patterns. And those patterns, if you extrapolate them, they become theories of a soggy conspiratorial sort. But there are a number of different currents within the elitist class, or the managerial elite, specifically those who run and staff our institutions, that the children belong to them, that the, you know, the child belongs to the community, the parents don't know, the teacher does. I mean, this is, and this dates back decades. And actually, it pops up in history over and over and over again when the community takes precedent over the parent, or the parent is basically the manufacturing unit of society, not of the family. And the breaking down of those bonds, while it's not specifically nested entirely within the way in which bureaucratic systems and every single major institution now approaches individuals, whatsoever, insofar as they do think of it in individuals. Also, the child, by means of the internet, individualism, late stage liberalism, has a notion of the self as self-determining, as, you know, basically, I am the center of the universe, and my parents are interrupting my development. My parents are in the way. And I went through that phase. Maybe you got along with your parents every step of the way, and you had to negotiate them to not push you away. You know, I don't want to be free yet, you know, or whatever. I don't know, but it's a multi-tier. There's a lot of things going on right now that are impacting specifically in the gender debate, but also if the medical industry, the psychological industry, and the teaching industry, the education industry, is already teaching the child as, okay, you have a gender? Like, okay, we'll hide it from your parents. We'll draft up these little things.
Yeah.
To what, where is it going to stop? What's the limiting force of that?
Yeah.
Other than voting, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, like, if we were to take that scenario and play it out to, like, its furthest extremity, if teachers and institutions feel entitled to come in between a child and their parents and perhaps, you know, facilitate some sort of emancipation or something, I'm just kind of using this as an example. Ultimately, that teacher, I mean, hopefully, isn't going to be the one to, like, house the child and, like, take them on from their parents. Like, if a child decides that my school is right, my parents are transphobic, they don't love me, I'm leaving.
Mm.
Are you following me here? Your face is so confused.
No, I'm just having ideas.
Okay. So, you know, if a teacher facilitates such a thing, where is the child going to go? Who is then going to take over ownership and care of the child? Sometimes I've seen cases where, like, another family who's super affirmative of their own gender questioning child acts as, like, a surrogate family and takes on a kind of runaway that is not being affirmed at home. So that happens. But if schools are doing this en masse, like, who becomes the ward of that child? Like, I don't really know. Does that mean they get turned over to some sort of, like, foster agency? Who takes on these children? Like, if there's going to be this mass exodus of kids from their home. Now, typically that's not what happens. Most cases, even terrifying cases where CPS is called, some CPS person shows up at the house and does, like, an evaluation and tells the parents to affirm the kid and mandates therapy or something. So most often, even the extreme cases don't end up with a child no longer being with the family.
But the government is telling the parent what to do and how to see the
child. Yes, it's terrifying. I'm not saying that's okay.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm just kind of, you asked this theoretical question about what happens when institutions kind of come in and take over this, like, parenting role. And I don't think it's sustainable, and I don't think it makes sense. And it certainly doesn't benefit the child in any way to be kind of floating along without the love and stability of their families. There are cases where there's serious dysfunction and a child may not be doing well at home. So I'm not saying that never happens.
Mm-hmm.
But the only real remedy to this is for individual families to become aware that this is a problem and to really work on their attachment relationship with their children. And you actually did a really good interview with Posey Peavy talking about how to best deal with the school. And she said something like, you know, get them with honey or kill them with kindness, or she used one of those kinds of phrases, which I really loved, because I think taking a highly combative stance towards any of this has its benefits, and I think it has its place, but it also has a lot of drawbacks. But for families who are in this position, your connection and relationship with your child is the thing that will save your family from these kinds of risks. And so parents really need to strategize around how to do that, how to stay connected, how to stay close.
Mm-hmm. So you do excellent work in your videos and on your podcast, Gender, A Wider Lens, of detailing mature family relationships and giving good, solid advice to, you know, bringing in and facilitating those bonds and even letting go in such a way as to even strengthen things. The idea that the state is unable to deal adequately with foster kids and orphans and wants to create more is odd, but that's just an odd comment to that. And this, again, is another inflection point, or a point where the gender conversation does extrapolate to the broader cultural issues that we have. And taking just the family unit of strengthening bonds and connections and attachment to the family unit can be extrapolated to the local community and even to maybe your county or something a little bit larger, to really think locally and make bonds and make connections with your school board, make, you know, be a part of your civic governance, you know, join clubs, because that ultimately has more power in the long term than thinking federally or thinking in terms of the global fight against these huge ideologies, ultimately, as we're dealing with people. And I see that with regards to a certain ongoing, almost interminable crisis in America having to do with health issues, there are certain mandates and moves that the government is making to control people in mass. And the only way I see that tide turning is people saying, no, you know, it ends here. You can't go any further than here. And having that community relationship, whether it's within your family to say no to the government or to this ideology, it begins and it ends with that relationship, right? With other people, not with this ideological battle for good or for ill. And there is a place for this ideological battling, but it comes down to human connection.
Yeah, what you're saying about the broader connections in the community makes me think about a couple of things. First, I'm thinking about this book. I think it's called Motherhood by Sarah Blaffer Hardy. And she's an anthropologist and an evolutionary biologist, I think. And her book was actually recommended to me by Heather Hying when I kind of put a blast out there on Twitter of like, what are some good books to help me understand like our evolutionary roots? And one of the things that Sarah Blaffer Hardy talks about in that book is just how integral alloparenting is. Alloparenting is the inclusion of like aunts, other moms, other people within the group to help support the raising of a child. And in another book that I recommend all the time called Hold On to Your Kids, it's about attachment in families and particularly attachment relationships during the teenage years. They talk about this too, how it's like a pretty contemporary problem that families are trying to play the role of being everything their child needs without the help of aunts, uncles, grandparents, neighbors, things like that. And so, you know, it can also help with family dysfunction, because let's say, for example, you happen to be one of those kids whose parents do have some really serious dysfunction in the home. If there's an extended family around, you can get some of your needs met at least through other people who love you and care about you and have an investment in your well-being. So like that,
such
that
as Reddit or Tumblr. I mean, that's a great place to find
hot boxing, which I learned about recently. But yeah, I mean, it's that community piece just kind of reminded me of that, because there are so many problems that are at least partially solved when you have that bigger web of network of people who intimately know you and care about you and your family. So, yeah.
Even the concept of attachment is very difficult. And there's this author who I'm sure you've heard on my channel, maybe read some of her work. She's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant woman. And I don't know why she's not yet known, because she's only been working for a year or whatever, like actually publicly, but it's Mary Harrington.
Oh, and she I love talks, her. Yeah.
She talks often about, she talks about liberalism. She talks about transhumanism. She talks about the gender stuff. She talks about feminism. She talks about the trad thing. Mm. And she, in a certain way, she even embraces the title of being reactionary. And I've done a video titled Reactionary Feminism. So it might be even going backwards in a way, or being regressive in a way. But what she is developing is this concept that is more aligned with the rights and the responsibilities and the values, broadly speaking, of women, but women situated in a family and a man who has a family, which is not thinking about the individual. It's thinking about an individual that has a dependent nature, especially the infirm. The beginning and the end of life are kind of cut out of this individualistic idea of what the human is. And I can see that beginning and end of life is kind of, well, not the end of life so much, but with childhood transition and the way that there are interventions with children, we're trying to jumpstart that individual as early as possible.
Yeah.
To a greater or lesser extent, either ideologically, conceptually, or through the, the school coming in and giving the child more power than the child necessarily needs. So, saying that there is a critique of liberalism and individualism, that there is a beginning and end of the individual, specifically in life, the child is not an individual, the person at the death's door is not an individual. How do we deal with that? And within the nexus of the family, tending the elderly and tending the young, that is where we can start to develop these ideas that might translate to a better conception of what a true human society or a good functioning liberal plus human society would be. So with that said, I'm laying the groundwork for what is this attachment thing?
Well, I think the first thing that came to my mind, well, a bunch of stuff went through my mind really, really quickly. First of which was, Sasha, you're a little bit full of shit because you say all this, but you live a very like lone wolf, isolated kind of life, which is really interesting.
23 hours a day.
23 hours of my day. I've always had a very independent spirit. I have bucked against my family in a lot of ways, like my whole life. So it's interesting that I'm advocating for this particular kind of family structure when really I pushed against that so hard on an individual level. I'm also thinking about how, when you look back at some of the ways that institutions used to advocate for this kind of community cohesion, sometimes it was through methods that are really unsavory, like shame and ostracizing people and guilt and pressure and squashing individuality. So it's like the other side of me understands completely why well-meaning people think if we can help instill a sense of individuality in people very young, they might be buffered from those kinds of, not buffered, but like, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Insulated. Vaccinated.
Vaccinated.
Yes, inoculated, yes. Maybe.
Inoculated, yeah. From that kind of like soul-crushing pressure to not be an individual. So, So I guess like that's my kind of critique of pushing for like community everything, family everything. However, when attachment is working the way it's supposed to work, it is not a coercion. It is a relationship that is safe and loving and warm and valuable and makes you feel like this person is the answer to what I'm looking for, like your parent. Okay. So in that book, for example, Hold On to Your Kids, they talk about the relationship between parent and child, especially if you have a teenager who's really formed attachments elsewhere. So this, an example of this is like the teenager who would rather be in their room with the door closed on Reddit all night rather than have like a 5-minute dinner with you, because they just are much more attached to their peers online than they are to parents. And the authors advocate for thinking about this relationship almost like a courtship. And they say you have to like woo your child's affections back. You have to be gentle. You have to create space for them. You have to, you know, give little moments of sweetness to entice them back. And they don't mean it in a manipulative way. They mean it in a way that you can't force your child to reconnect with you. You really have to earn that trust back. And they give all kinds of really great strategies in the book of like, how do you rebuild a bond with a teenager who's very defensive, who doesn't want to be around you, who would rather be with anybody online rather than be with you. I mean, that's a really heartbreaking thing. And they even kind of relate it to how it might feel if you discovered your partner was having an affair, like the absolute heartbreak to know that this person who you love, their attention is completely somewhere else. And so they really talk about this in the context of developing a trusting, meaningful, safe, powerful relationship. So when attachment is working well, it is working well because it's really helping your child and they need you, rather than something mandated onto the child by the parent. I don't know if that makes sense. And sometimes, sometimes with a young teen, there are mandates involved. I mean, parents do have to set limits and boundaries and put guardrails around certain things. So I don't mean to paint a picture that, you know, having appropriate attachment with a teenager is all roses and rainbows. I mean, there are going to be conflicts as well. But when reattachment happens and when the attachment is preserved and maintained, the child wants to turn to the parents more than anybody else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. You look at the stuff, I look at the stuff that I do over time, and in any given discussion or making a given point, I could easily see where it breaks down. It no longer makes sense. I could easily see we're saying, you know, we need to be reasonable, or you catch more flies with honey, you know. Actually, well, you know, when you see what's coming after you, or there are times when very firm stances are made. And within the broad conversation of individualism versus communalism, I just run into these places where with regards to the gender thing, you say that there's this child who isn't getting enough from their parents and they don't have an extended network, or they do, but the internet is already made for them. And what they end up doing, it can be the case, and we know people who've gone through this, they get enmeshed in this gender ideology and they end up thinking the same as everybody else, or going through this very simple pattern of behavior. And then the stories with the detransitioners, broadly speaking, are ones of young women or young men kind of getting out of that and kind of rediscovering their individual hood. And you can see that there are certain personalities that go through, they get really fundamental about one thing and then they get out of it, and they get really unfundamental about another thing and they get out of it. So there are certain people who never really get their sense of stability or what we call critical thinking or an individual. A critical thinking is I trust myself, I trust my senses, I trust my mind. It is very individualistic, but there's a certain point or a negotiation with being with other people that's really concretized in the family. And I don't know if you can scale it up to the community or to the nation, you know, it, every time it makes a step up on some sort of scale, it kind of changes into a more and more idealistic nature. Like, I belong to my country, my fatherland, or my motherland, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. patriotism mm-hmm. is one way of having an idea of America as something that we're all a part of. That's just an idea that has room for all these different ethnicities, all these different religions, all these different learning styles or being styles. Somehow it works together. And for anybody who's peeking into this episode, I don't do this much talking, but me and Sasha have had so many conversations that I feel that I'm allowed to have more space in the conversation than
you're allowed. Plus we just talked, which I'll say we interviewed you on our podcast, but yes, I want to go back to your point.
Yeah.
I think one thing that popped up for me was when you were talking about how some individuals go from being really extreme about one thing to another. If we look at that from the lens of attachment needs, it could make a lot of sense that until a person finds somebody or a healthy, non-volatile attachment figure, that they're just going to keep bouncing around from being really into one thing to really into another. And those people in that group, that's my people, and they have my back, and I will defend them. Like, it's, if it's an attachment need, that's really powerful. And I have no actual data on this, but this is completely a guess. But I would be really curious about people who are going through this process, whether it's transition or detransition, if they have really secure, healthy, stable attachment figures in their lives, does it make the intensity of their ideological buy-in less intense? And I mean, I've definitely met people who have gotten back into this debate because they see something unhealthy going on and they really feel convicted to speak about it. I'm thinking about like someone like Aaron Terrell, who was just on our show. So there are lots of like just positive, I think, altruistic motivations to get involved in this. But I also wonder for some people who feel really lonely still and like feel like transition wrecked their life and they don't have stable, reliable people that they can attach to, does it make them more vulnerable to going into like extreme kind of groups? Does that
or
make sense?
Or does it make them less, feel less vulnerable to be involved in some sort of meaningful activity? So I actually, here's a way to bounce it off of that. I'm reading this one book, Awake Not Woke. It's by a Catholic author, and she's talking about the people who are caught up in wokeness, and she defines it in the book as seeking meaning. And so not being compassionate towards those people is really to miss the point and probably not helpful to them or to society at large. And so when people speak in terms of seeking meaning, broadly speaking, speaking an activity that brings them meaning, one source of meaning, perhaps even the source of meaning, arguably, I don't think so, but arguably is a relationship or is found within relationship. One caveat would be one's work, one's career, or what one builds would be the other thing. But usually it's built for, or at least the benefits of having work kind of, you know, splash forward into, you know, if you have a family or the people that you take care of, you know. So there's this non-work life. So there is work that is meaningful, but there's also relationships that are meaningful. And ideology is like, it can be kind of a mix of the two, or people can treat a social movement as their work, as their calling. And actually there's too many people that are trying to fix the world and they're kind of screwing it up, if you ask me, but because they're so disconnected from, you know, making a chain out of metal, you know, like their ancestors did for thousands of years. So there's relationship meaning and there's work meaning. But when we just talk about meaning as meaning as meaning, there's art, I guess, would be another thing which would go into the work category. But if you're talking to a romantic poet, one leads to the other, you know. So, yeah.
You know, that's interesting, because as you were talking about work meaning, I mean, my first instinct which I then corrected with another instinct, was like, you know, I think for women, relationships do tend to play a bigger role of importance. And I think maybe some men feel really invested in whatever they're building through work. And then, you know, then I kind of thought, well, I don't know, because some of the hardest working people I know in this gender world are women who are putting together like the most incredible resources, organizations, and pulling things together in a way that is really impressive.
This work is about people. I mean, just
this work is about people. Yeah. And even for myself, I mean, I'm like, work is a huge, huge, huge part of my life, but it's a series of relationships. My relationships with clients, my relationships with people I've met, my relationships with other clinicians. I mean, work is a series of relationships for me, especially as a therapist. So, yeah, I don't know, that came to mind. But yeah, so
that's an interesting inquiry then, just broadly speaking, about how work and relationship become synonymous. And it goes back to what Erica Bakuloki and then Mary Harrington talk about pre-industrial women, specifically women in pre-industrial or agrarian America, where the household was very productive, and mm-hmm. the men and the women, it was very land-based. Mm-hmm. And once the man started traveling and more urban kind of communities began to expand, the woman kind of got trapped in this, you know, kind of like this productive, but it was kind of a lesser kind of value. So it's really interesting through these humanities properly conducted that the work of relationship or relational work is made possible in mm-hmm. a way, mm-hmm. and even broadened beyond just very tight communities like matchmakers, fortune tellers. I don't know the old timey psychologists before there was psychology. I know that there were wise women, but I don't
like
know.
Like a guy with a monocle or something.
I'm thinking like women have always been doing this work of their work. Their real work has always been tending the community.
Yeah.
But the expertiseization of that role of the mm-hmm. wise woman or mm-hmm. the, you know, whatever mm-hmm. that is.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, it makes it interesting because you have all these ethical lines, you know, and especially in psychology, like it's a professional relationship, but it's so personal that then you're like, well, there's the line
it's
here
really
that doesn't exist
it?
Outside mm-hmm. of that weird container.
Yeah, this is something that Stella and I have been thinking through a little bit in various episodes on the podcast. We haven't done any episode on it specifically, but like, we both are a little bit skeptical of the field of psychology and the field of therapy in general, not just because of all this gender stuff.
Yeah.
But because it
and
really...
And it can't be because of the APA. They wouldn't make you skeptical at all.
I'm trying not to like follow too much of that news. At this point, it's almost like tabloid news. You know, it's so bad.
It's telling, yeah.
Yeah. It's like every day I see some article with some crazy thing that happens and it's like, I can't even keep up. Like I can't even keep up with the quick rollout of like totally insane things that don't make sense. But yeah, I mean the therapy relationship is, I think that's the reason we have all these regulations and all these standards and all these ethical guidelines, because there's such a tremendous amount of power in this kind of relationship. And I think the problem is also that as we continue to develop this over-reliance on experts, families end up outsourcing their power to the therapist. So you have this lopsided situation by which parents are putting all their stock in the therapist. The therapist will be the one who has these deep conversations with my kid, or, oh, this is really difficult. You should be sure to talk to your therapist about that. And so, and these are well-meaning parents. They're trying to give their kid a space that's not mom and dad where they can feel comfortable to talk. Like on the surface, that looks really great. But then you really have made your family very vulnerable to like whatever the therapist's own fucked up problems are. And I was listening to Corinna and Grace, this brilliant discussion. Corinna Khan, every time I hear her talk, I'm just like, my mind is blown. She's very amazing. But she was talking about how, you know, gender therapists, they were just talking about their own experiences with gender therapy. Like, gender therapists have their own personal biases and personal gain to be had from just affirming everybody. And I mean, there are a lot of reasons this could show up or ways this could show up. But I mean, one simple thing that Corinna said was like, I don't trust that a transgender therapist would really be able to help their client truly explore without just affirming them. And I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily always true, but we know that therapy involves transference and countertransference. What that means is that if I am a therapist, let's say I'm your therapist and you know that I'm Egyptian by some weird reason. I don't know why you would know that, but let's say you did.
You told me, yeah.
Okay, so I've told you this. I've self-disclosed that. And you had, let's say, a boss at your job that was Egyptian that was driving you completely nuts and you were really angry at him. You might be very nervous, actually, and walking on eggshells trying to tell me about your animosity towards the boss, lest I interpret that, you know, your animosity towards your boss is that he's Egyptian. Like, maybe there is a cultural barrier. Maybe he's got this aggressive way of talking that, like, in our culture is very normal. So, like, it's incredibly complicated and nuanced. It's not just whether or not I, as an Egyptian person, can listen to you. It's like, are you even willing to tell me what you really think? Because we all do have different identities. I mean, this is where it's actually valuable to think through. So, I mean, there are so many complicated issues that go on here, and the therapy relationship is incredibly, it's tender, and it has a lot of power, and it's very powerful. So I always say bad therapy is worse than no therapy. Mm-hmm. And I tell parents all the time, I mean, what do you think people did decades ago when teenagers didn't all have their own therapist, you know? And I think I say that it's a bit facetious, but the real answer is actually we had really powerful extended networks of people like caring about children. And you had probably more family around and there were cousins and like lots of other young people to play with and hang out with and bounce ideas off of, and your older sister's a couple years older and your cousin's gone through this. Like, that's different from what we have now. So parents have a bit of a vacuum. Like, there isn't that extended network. And so they're looking for that professional help. But it's, I do say it's, be careful, be really careful.
So the extension of the individual, then the hyperinflation of individualism as a cultural value eventually starts to uproot individuals. And then by some lucky means, a certain portion of them get married and settle down and then they have kids. But so they're a little pod, but they're disconnected from all the previous relationships and stuff. So the kid has to sort through all these random relationships if you're living in a big city, which is okay. I mean, it's always been a gamble. You never chose, like, if you were in a poor town or another poor town, the people that you're set up with are the people that you're set up with. You might have fared much better and found somebody who'd been a much better mentor in one town over, but you had no choice over that. And so there's more choice now, potentially, but that obscures the fact that the relationships, especially mitigated through something as institutionalized as therapy, and then the idea of therapy as these experts that they went to these colleges, of course they know what they're talking about. And once people start to realize that, no, the colleges and all the schools, like once that
everyone's
actually
drinking the same. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Once that spills out, it's going to, again, and so I just keep on, you know, somebody asked me, I keep on saying this over and over and over again. I'm getting tired of saying this, but somebody asked me, what's your advice for prepping? And I said, you know, I thought about it. I'm like, I don't know. I can get some beans. I'm like, well, no, join a church, actually. Like, actually figure out a way to hang out with people around you in a way that you're not talking about you have, there's some sort of transcendent activity, whether it's a sport or something. I think certain religions, insofar as they are regulated correctly, provide something that's higher than everybody. You shoot up, you sing some songs, and then you go back and then you just drink some tea, right? And that is the best prep for any sort of catastrophe, barring the moon exploding and raining down upon us, you know?
You know, that's really interesting. I wish I had that kind of glowy sense. You know, I mean,
I don't follow my advice.
You're drinking a beer, you blasphemer, or whatever.
This is my church.
Beer church?
No, the podcast.
Oh, okay.
At 6:30.
Well, you are spending time with people. I mean, to be fair, that checks one of the boxes in your description here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there are different kinds of faith groups that have different impacts on their congregation. So if you can find something that is fulfilling.
There's got to be something, though. There's got to be something that allows people to plug into each other that's not... okay, I was going to say not ideological, but the church is specifically ideological, well-regulated. It allows people to think about the transcendent or something that's not political, right? And when I interviewed, really bad with names, a couple weeks ago, I interviewed somebody who infiltrated Antifa, and she talked about all the different methods that Antifa and leftist groups have come up with, where they create a sense of community. You know, you go to one of these rallies, they give you a black t-shirt and a bottle filled with cement and a cute puppy dog and a cupcake, you know, and then a Molotov cocktail at a certain point in the night, you know, so. So they're fulfilling that certain need. A certain community need has to have a community purpose, and that's what we have without some sort of ideological container.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Like, to be honest, I've been having kind of a hard time adjusting to being here in Arizona.
You've been here for 9 months or a year?
We moved in March.
Okay.
But, you know, I grew up here. So I spent all of middle school and high school here. So I have a long history here. But I was in Houston for like almost 20 years or so. That was a long time. And I felt like it was so familiar. And I think that's what's really hard to adjust to. Like, even though I was here as a kid, we live in a totally different part of town and nothing is familiar yet. Like, I still don't have any instinct really on like where stuff is beyond the things I do all the time. And I don't really like I would never run into anybody I knew anywhere. So like, there's this weird feeling of isolation, but like the one place that I go every single day, which is the gym, like it really dawned on me that this is like the one place that I actually am starting to like be familiar with things, with people. Like, oh yeah, I see that guy every day. Oh, hey, how are you doing? How's your ankle? Like that sense of like you do the same thing all the time in the same place with the same people really speaks to something. And, you know, I think the fact that we also have this gift and the curse of the internet, like I'm also noticing that I'm being pulled out of my life into my online spaces almost constantly. If there's a lull moment, I'm going to check Twitter to see what's happening. And so I've noticed this interesting kind of contrast between like, oh my God, I actually have been doing the same exact thing all the time. And it actually has created some connections and a sense of familiarity that I've been craving. And yet with the rest of my time, I'm just constantly being pulled in a million virtual directions. And I think that idea of like going to the same space with the same people, if that's church, that's what it is for some people. And I hope people can find that. Sweat church. Yeah, I guess so.
I was having a rough time. I moved from one part of this peninsula to the other part of the peninsula, and I lost an important beast, my cat. I lost him, and he was a grounding for me. Like, I had invested a lot of grounding and embodiment with him, and I got him right before the whole internet thing happened to me. So where I was
kind of thrown. Bijou?
It's Bjorno.
Oh, okay.
Old timey. You have to look back. Every once in a while, I'll post something. He's a black and white cat with the white paws and stuff. But I lost him. And it's weird. I don't know why I bring that up. But like that was, we moved and then the cat was gone. And then I started noticing that I was really unable to regulate my emotions. And I called you up in a panic actually one time because I made the video and it turned out that it might have not been the best video to make and has nothing to do with feminism actually, which would end up resulting in a bunch of other stress later on down the road. But you know, I remember you saying, I'm like, I'm really freaking out, I don't know how to deal with this. And you're like, get into your body. And that, and then over the course of time, noticing how, like, I'd wake up at night and the internet's just like this face sucker, just like, where are you, Benjamin? Where are you? You know, and just becoming more and more aware of that. And then earlier this year, and so I regulated. Ramadan helped. Part of Ramadan for me was like, no phone, you know, like I'm really regulating this, you know, and separating that. And then I had this dream I've talked about on my channel, and maybe you heard me talk about, where Satan came to me, or Lucifer, and he promised me riches and controversy.
I remember this, you know, dream.
And all he had to do was touch me once an hour all night long. Like, that was the cost of all that. And I realized that, like, that's the internet. The internet is
once an hour. And, dude, I wish I had the freedom of not being touched until once an hour.
Well, even at night? Oh, you only sleep. Well, you're the opposite of what we started. You only sleep 2 hours a day.
No, I do sleep well. No, luckily. I'm not, like, up checking my phone at night. But, okay, yeah, I get it. That once an hour thing definitely feels like a metaphor for the internet.
But I learned to separate myself from that. And even though I am still really connected and it still has an addictive thing, it doesn't have power over my emotions. I do not invest my heart into it as I was before then. I keep it a little bit outside of me, though it's still enwrapping me, you know, like a satellite spinning pretty close to the surface. But, you know, and that's been helpful and open up room for other sorts of connections or deeper sorts of connections, even if I use the internet mostly to affect those.
Yeah. Well, maybe on that note, is it time for us to disconnect and
1 second
make dinner?
Yeah, okay. We should make dinner. Okay, that's a good question. We have to do some random question.
Oh, yeah. You've been doing this. I really enjoy that at the end of the episodes where you're like, so what are your things?
Well, I have a very specific than normal question for you, Sasha.
Okay. All right.
Culinary excursions of 2021 from Sasha Ayad.
Okay.
Best meals, high points.
Last night, this is a little embarrassing, but I was thinking about, story.
No,
I was thinking about how Helena made this funny tweet about like how girls don't really want to become men, like the guy who's worried about his brisket that he's cooking this weekend. And I get a little bit like competitive. I'm like, oh, well, not just guys barbecue. And I was like, I've never literally barbecued by myself. So I actually did some barbecuing last night. And I was so excited about it. It was awesome.
Was it a full beast or a part of a beast?
No, I marinated and grilled up some chicken.
Okay, chicken, what are we talking about? Like a whole chicken, you know, legs?
Making chicken is a bit like playing Russian roulette, because if it's not cooked, you die. Well, you don't die, but you get really sick. So it's like, you know, you can make a steak and kind of undercook it, nothing will happen. But if you undercook chicken...
Is this a playing with Egyptian story time, or is this Egyptian appendix?
It was like Greek style chicken, and it was really good.
Well, so, what are we talking
about? Share the YouTube video.
Hold on. Okay. Chicken tenders, chicken legs,
chicken breast,
thighs.
Chicken breast, chicken breast, marinated chicken breast.
How long did you marinate them?
Like all day. I woke
in
up
yogurt
early in the morning. The marinade is olive oil, lemon, garlic, thyme, rosemary, Dijon mustard, soy sauce, and mayonnaise.
Okay.
And salt and pepper, of course.
Yes.
They sat in that marinade all day, bathing in it. And then threw them on the fire, and they were so good.
Hold on. What kind of coal did you use? What kind of fuel?
Our complex here, we still are living that apartment life, unfortunately. But our complex has like a gas barbecue.
Like a community pool, but you put your food instead of your kids in it?
Yes, exactly like that. Okay, we have a pool, and then outside of the pool, there's a barbecue. It's not in the pool. Isn't that luxurious? They didn't put the barbecue in the pool. That's how.
Well, you don't put your kids in the barbecue either. You put the kids in the pool and the chicken on the Barbie.
True. Unless you're Hansel and Gretel. Then you go in the oven.
Oh. You're whipping out the Lisa Marciano who just appeared on my channel.
I think about her with all these fairy tales. I can't wait to see that interview.
The sides, though.
I just made a salad.
Wait, no starch?
It wasn't
no
like a full
carrots?
I don't know. No. No. Hmm. I don't really much starchiness.
Okay. And what kind of salad then?
I mean, I don't know if there's a name for it. Just like a bunch of like
leafy greens.
But I'm really particular. I do not like spring mix. I don't like when you're trying to eat salad and the lettuce like reaches out of your mouth and like claws you in the face. I don't like that at all. I like simple, like butter lettuce kind of stuff.
Okay. And what was the dressing like a blue cheese?
Do you know the kind of leafy greens I'm talking about that are like sharp?
Yeah, the baby like,
they're like
branches. Orange and maroon. Yeah.
I'll eat them, but it's not my preference. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the dressing?
I don't remember what probably some kind of maybe some pesto dressing I think I did last night.
Okay.
It's good stuff.
There we go.
Yeah, what
so
about
you? Barbecued.
Yeah, I barbecued last night. It was really great. It was fun.
Yeah.
Felt very, very capable. What about you? What are some culinary concoctions that you've come up with?
Culinary concoctions. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Like a medical thing. Culinary concoctions. I have my smoker. And I did a shoulder the other night, which was okay, but it was store bought, so it was the store put the stuff on.
Oh,
I did a shoulder before then. Do you eat pork?
Mm-hmm.
Is that outside of your thing? Yeah. So one day I'll I can't use a community barbecue for the stuff I do. I need a smoker.
No, you have a serious, real barbecue.
No, it's only like a couple hundred bucks. So once you guys move out of the apartment life, I'll get your.
I can't wait. Yeah.
Fancy man, something for you to use to cook.
We already have a friend here who's going to give us her smoker. We're just waiting for us to put it.
Oh, cool! We can live stream while we both smoke because it takes about 2 hours.
Yeah, it's a long process.
Yeah, you just.
My fiance's brother is like a fantastic chef, and he makes all these amazing things. He sous vides things. He deep fries turkeys. He makes smoke things. He makes the best brisket I've ever had. Oh, he's the best. So we're lucky to get to go over and eat.
Well,
there.
See, that's you're allo digesting.
That's right. Allo consumption for sure.
All in the recording so you can like catch that as soon as the siren started you're like I gotta chase the ambulance.
Does it feel like I need to chase the we have a lot of interesting stuff that happens around this apartment. Very good people watching. I wouldn't raise kids here, but it's fun for me.
I've actually been to that area of town. It's pretty interesting. A little bit of slice of Arizona.
I'm really curious to hear more about your time here in Scottsdale, Arizona. Bye, people.
Oh, no. There we go. Okay.